Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the programme. And thank you for joining us on Sunday night on ABC Radio. Our guest is former Premier of South Australia, former executive with World Vision Australia, Lynn Arnold, soon to be Deacon, the Reverend Lynn Arnold. Lynn, welcome to Sunday Night.
Good evening, John. Great to be here.
This is an extraordinary path. I mean, in politics you learn one thing, the art of cynicism, surely. Cynicism, duplicity, double speak, and here you are, sort of...
Well, maybe not double speak so much as double meaning. I've been a minister with one meaning of the word, and now, God willing, I'll be a minister with another meaning of the word.
Indeed. But ministry is a calling.
Absolutely, yes, yes. But I would argue that our body politic is full of people on all sides who have had a sense of calling for a cause. And so that sense of calling is now moved to another plane, taken a quantum leap, if you like.
It is an extraordinary thing, isn't it? If you look back at Australian politics during the period that you've been involved and others, that in political leadership across the states and at the federal level, there have been more explicitly religious people, people with an explicit religious commitment, over the last decade or so than we've had for many, many years. And yet the Australian public has been seeing a decline in religious observance. And I think about people like yourself and Jeff Gallop at the state mm-hmm. level, at the federal level, on both sides of politics. Mm-hmm. You've had Kim Beazley, mm-hmm. Kevin Rudd, Tony Abbott as mm-hmm. an example. Something of a paradox here?
Maybe, but maybe not. In fact, in the Anglican Church in South Australia, when I'm ordained next Saturday, I'll be part of the largest ordination group for some years. So it has actually been growing in recent years. And they're more than just ex-politicians. I'm the only ex-politician among them. But you're right. I think what happens when people have spent a long time in public service, they want to think about what the next phase of their life should be. And people will make different decisions. But it's always about, it can't just stop here. There must be something that we could go on to do of significance. And I went through quite a journey of reflection on that whole process. And it first of all took me into the not-for-profit sector, as you've mentioned, World Vision for 11 years, then Anglicare for 4.5 years. And so when that came to a natural conclusion, I had to go into another period of reflection as to where to now.
Spirituality is an important part of that. That is where you get the sense of your centre, and I'd like to come to that in a few moments' time. But this sense of vocation is also something there, that for you, a job is never a job. It's something about who you are.
Oh, very much so. That's right, yes. Yes, you are not the work you do. The work is part of you, and therefore part of how you engage with the rest of society and engage with the bigger picture of the eternal world.
Mm-hmm. Then let's take this opportunity to track back a little on your life. What led you into politics, and what led you into, and did you always have a sense that politics was in some way connected to a spiritual calling?
Oh, I certainly have seen it as part of that bigger picture. But you asked me what led me into politics. I come from a family that have a keen interest in the world and conditions in the world. My mother is a very political person in her views. My father had a very deep sense of justice. When I was 6 years old, I wanted to be prime minister. My mates wanted to be policemen and firemen, and we all failed. They didn't end up policemen and firemen, and I never ended up prime minister. But I say that just really to indicate that from the youngest age possible, I was interested in politics. When I was a teenager, I was a bit of a tragic, really. My best Saturday night only took place once every 3 years, election night. Other people's Saturday night took place a lot more often.
Of course, we're having this discussion in the week of one of the great moments of global politics, that is the anniversary of the assassination of JFK. Mm. Did that impinge on your psyche at all as a kid growing up?
Well, yes, it did, in two sorts of ways. One, the very presidency of President Kennedy was quite a breath of fresh air at the time. I mean, there's been a lot of historiographic revisiting of that presidency, but nevertheless, at the time, it was quite an exciting period to see things happening. But then we had another aspect which came afterwards. We had Lyndon Johnson's bringing in the significant reforms in race relations that Kennedy started but did not deliver. But then Kennedy also started and Johnson did deliver the involvement in the Vietnam War. And I'm part of that generation, the 6 o'clock news generation of the 60s, who would watch the unfolding war on TV and didn't like what we saw.
How much did that moratorium movement and the restiveness on campus, the sort of whole notion of this 68 to 72 period, mm-hmm. where you had that period of is revolution coming mm-hmm. in the air, continue to linger throughout your political psyche?
What I think has lingered about it is that you can take on the direction of the wind and refuse to accept it, that you can actually seek to change it. In the 1960s, that's what we were doing. The prevailing wind was you don't oppose these sorts of things. If government decides we're going to go to war, we go to war and you simply support it. We said, no, you don't have to accept that. If government decides you're all going to be conscripted, you just have to accept that. We said, no, you don't have to just accept that. So that premise that it is possible to take on things and say, no, we can go in another direction, I hope has always been part of the way I've tried to live out my life. And certainly, I guess, what I'm now seeing in my new role, which will have a very social justice focus to it, about taking on the wind direction in our society.
The critique of the baby boomer generation has been consistently that they started off as idealists, 68 to 72. What ended up happening was they became the me generation. Their idealism very soon translated into, yes, we've got to have freedom, but it's freedom for me.
Well, yes, I don't know that I'd fully accept that argument. I think if we see the amount of active giving for overseas aid organisations, for example, that really was non-existent in the 1960s. By the mid-1970s, it was starting to grow, and as the 60s generation started to earn a lot more, they were starting to give a lot more. And we saw a massive increase over the following decades of the amount that individuals will give for overseas aid and support. And I use that as an indicator to say that there's a lot of not me about it too.
You're one of those who entered politics, ascended to the heights, Premier of South Australia, yet you also endured what other political leaders have endured. And of course, it's become something of a cliche that a successful politician is never successful in their own mind. They always depart with a sense of loss. Kevin Rudd, mm-hmm. facing a sense of loss. He too, very strongly committed to his Christian faith, yet people saw, if one wants to be kind about it, people saw here somebody who in the exercise of power is being accused of not actually representing what his ideals say he should be. And this leads us to this whole discussion about the area of political compromise and the exercise of power. A dangerous weapon.
Well, first of all, you have to understand certain basic premises. One is that the body politic is a reflection of the wider society, and therefore it contains the same pressures and temptations as the wider society does. And if you're going to walk away from the body politic because you're not prepared to face those pressures and temptations, then you'd really need to walk away from society too. Secondly, there are people in the body politic who have very high ideals. There are others who have, I guess, maybe somewhat pedestrian ideals, and there are others who have some pretty basic motives. But that also reflects the wider society. So you can't be chased away by things like that. And what you have in going into politics, if it's in your blood, and I used to say this to students when I used to address them in schools, if it's in your blood, you've got to try and express it. Then you have to find the best fit in a party sense, but you will never find a perfect fit. And you then have to make a determination where the fit doesn't quite fit you. How serious is it? If it's about some relatively minor matters from your conscience point of view, well, you live with it. If, however, it's a more serious matter, then you have to make a critical decision. And I indeed crossed the floor on my own party, I think, about six times in my time in Parliament, because there were things that I couldn't fit with. Now, you know, I didn't choose to leave the party because I felt I had my chance to express my view. And there were other things about the party I was a member of that I felt very adequately and accurately fitted my vision.
You said that as a young person, you aspired to be Prime Minister of Australia, you made Premier of South Australia, not bad, some would say. Yet in terms of the coherence of that vision, that must have been a massive disappointment when you found you're in a position where the only realistic decision for you was to leave politics.
At the start of my political career, I knew there would be a finite life to it. This would not be something I'd go on forever. The longest-serving member of the South Australian Parliament was the late Sir Lancelot Stirling, who served in Parliament 49 years and 6 months. Two questions I ask. One is, how did he stand it so long? And the second question is, having gone that far, why didn't he do the next 6 months and tidy up a half century? Anyway, that's by the by. But I knew I wouldn't be in politics for the rest of my career. And I thought it would be something like a 15 or 20, at greatest, I guess, maybe 25 years. I didn't know how the end would come. I perhaps would have preferred it not to have come the way it did. But I knew that there would be a time when I would need to move on, not only for my sake, not only for my party's sake, but for the state's sake. You do need a turnover of leadership. You actually need a turnover of governments. Our democratic pluralism is not helped by having no turnover of governments.
Of course, we are seeing the revelations of other politicians and the way they've handled a shift in career. Your career shift, though, seemed to maintain a consistent arc. You've mentioned that you went first in to work with World Vision and then latterly with Anglicare. That's connected to the other strong theme that runs
yes,
through your
life. Yes, it is, but there is an episode that I need to interpolate into that. When I left politics, as a family, we went to live in Spain for 2 years, as a time out, really, an R&R. I also did some study in Spain. I started my PhD and did a business diploma. But at that time, my thought was, I've worked a lot with business when I've been in government, as Minister of State Development, as Premier, as Minister of Agriculture, and so on. Wouldn't it be nice to work inside business and be part of that side of development in our economy? So that was where my vision was sort of sitting at that moment of leaving politics, going to Spain, doing some consultancy in the business world while I was in Spain, coming back, working for a company for a period of time. But it started to pall. It didn't fill something in me. And they were lovely people I was working with, a good company, but it didn't. It left a yearning within me. And it was at that moment that somebody at our church tapped me on the shoulder and said, Lynn, while you've been away in Spain, I joined the board of World Vision and we're looking for a new CEO. Would you put your hat in the ring? And that had been the furthest thought from my mind at that point. But I gave it some thought, and over a period of time with some deep reflection involving the family as well, I was asked to take the role, and it suddenly revealed that God will open doors in the most interesting and unusual ways sometimes. He'll also shut them sometimes too.
So this began to draw you into a path that was more connected with your community life, in a way.
Well, it enabled me to have an aha moment, I guess, right. Because here was I, done this work in Parliament, in 11 years in Cabinet and 15 years in Parliament, then looking to what I thought was the next logical step, but forgetting that I'd actually had these other interests over the years, including community service. When I was 18, I had the chance to go to Indonesia for a Young Asian Leaders Seminar for 3 weeks and was enchanted by what I learnt about international development. But that had sort of disappeared in the memory a bit. This episode at church, when his friend Rex Keeley tapped me on the shoulder, and then the reflection over that, and then the invitation to take the role, suddenly said, aha, of course. How did I not see that? And so I had 11 wonderful years in World Vision. I've been asked, did they meet my expectations? And I say they met my expectations, albeit in ways I never expected, because it was a more profound journey of faith and of understanding of the development process than I could ever have guessed.
World Vision expanded your horizons, I guess, in terms of the nature of politics too, because at the time you were in World Vision, we go through a period of the Millennium Goals, mm-hmm. We go through the arrival through the churches of things like the Micah Challenge, which aims mm-hmm. at getting churches refocused on that. And there was a period where churches began to turn from this inward looking about who we are to a consciousness about the world as a primary responsibility.
I'd been in my younger years, I had become a Quaker, and of course Quakers were very active in social issues for a long time. I mean, way long before me, ever since the 17th century. And so I was really aware that that's what faith should be. It's not only the Matthew 28 call of the Great Commission to all, every knee shall bow. It's the Matthew 25, in as much commission, in as much as you did it to the least of these, you did it to me, that's always been part of my understanding. And so as other churches might come into that discussion, my feeling was, oh, well, you're coming back to the gospel, that's where it was in the first place.
Lynn Arnold, let's now talk about the spiritual journey. Mm-hmm. Have you ever doubted the presence of God?
I don't know that I've ever doubted the presence of God. I've certainly doubted my relationship with God, and I found that in a very difficult place at times. So it's very much a valley and peaks one. And indeed, when I decided that I needed to think about what was going to happen after Anglicare, I'd been in Parliament for 15 years, then I was in the not-for-profit sector, World Vision, Anglicare, just 15 years, I knew it was time to move on, and I didn't know what. And I wondered if I should pray about it, which I did. And I went through the Orthodox Lent for 49 days in 2012. I prayed even more intensely each day than I normally do, read my Bible more intensely, found prayers that others have read and posted them on my Facebook page as it was capturing my mood each day of doing it. And going through a dietary fast too as part of the rigors of it. And what I found in those 49 days is there were some wonderful peaks of looking at this glorious horizon of God's spiritual light there. But there were valleys there too. There were times when it was actually quite dark and quite bleak. And I remember saying to somebody, especially about the 35th to the 39th day, I look back on the prayers I posted and they're quite bleak prayers. And this friend I mentioned it to, he said, did you not expect to find the fauna of the night? If Jesus in the wilderness was facing the fauna, the beasts and the other temptations, why would a human being face anything less than that? And so it was part of that journey of climbing up through that, knowing that, never doubting that God was there, but finding myself in a complex place about, is this my calling? And then in the last week of that Lent, there were seven nights of services continuously, about 28 hours of services at Orthodox churches every night from the Sunday night through to the following Sunday morning. The first few nights of those services, I've been to many Orthodox services, by the way, over the years. The first few nights were good, but not riveting. And I was starting to feel a bit flat and a bit, have I missed the point somehow about what I should be doing? And then as the week progressed, it started to clutch me more and more. And by the end of the week, on that Saturday night service that starts at 9 o'clock Saturday night and goes through to 3 o'clock Sunday morning, when you end with that Christos Anesti moment, which is emotionally very powerful, but it was also spiritually very powerful. And at that moment, I knew that, yes, this was what I now needed to do.
Truth for you is revealed in a spiritual pathway.
Yes.
The spirituality,
yes,
is in some ways the essence of the kernel of truth you're dealing with here. Mm-hmm. You say you took an interest in Orthodox spirituality. John Taverner, of course, who died only a week or so ago, is somebody else who comes out of that 60s generation, finds something in Orthodox spirituality. And a number of people have commented to me, what is it about Orthodox spirituality that people are finding so interesting?
This is very interesting because there's been something of a coming back to it as people have gone to revisit how the early church fathers, and they mainly were all fathers, though there were some very impressive early church mothers too, looked at the faith questions and did it in this deeply spiritual sense. And so I went back to reading some of these early writings. And then I found that in the liturgies, which some people decry as just being a lot of noise and not faithful things, more clanging cymbals, I guess, I found that in the liturgy there is a very deep spiritual richness. And I got a lot out of that. I was fortunate enough to be able to have bilingual liturgies so I could actually understand what was being said. I then went and spent, when I was premier, I was invited to Greece by the Greek government, and I ended up spending a weekend at Mount Athos in monastic retreat. And that was a wonderful, enriching, nourishing experience.
You aligned that with what's been going on in recent years in secular society and the sort of aggressive push of the new atheism that leaves the whole question of spirituality aside and goes back to the old sort of intellectual knots of religion. It goes to the questions of deep time and how it is that if the universe is 14.3 billion years old, all of a sudden the last sort of twinkling of an eye, God decides he's going to take an interest. It's a bit of a paradox there.
Yep.
Also, the red in tooth and claw nature of creation for the bulk of the existence of life. These are problems which don't engage you?
It's interesting you talk about this because they're engaging me enormously in very interesting ways. My last assignment for my graduate diploma, which I just finished a few weeks ago, has become something I want to build on as a possible master's thesis of theology, and that is the apologetics of catastrophe. You know, we have the question, how can God have allowed the tsunami? How can God have allowed the Holocaust to take place? And in the period of rationalism, there was a very strong push that faith had got it wrong. But all you needed was human rationality, and that would prevent the Holocaust, because we were innately able to do this. Well, the Holocaust took place in the period of rationalism. And so we're now moving in the postmodern area that it's not just faith that's in the witness box to the cross-examination of how can this have happened under your theodicy. The rationalists are also being asked, how can this have happened under your sociodicy, if I can coin a word? And so what we see is actually a yearning in a large part of society that I think is going well beyond atheism. It's actually looking for some deeper meaning. It's not necessarily yet satisfied by the Christian narrative or other faith narratives, and that's a challenge for people like myself and others to do the connecting. But it certainly is a yearning. The whole I'm no fan of New Age ideas, but they sit on top of a deep hunger and yearning that rationalism has not been able to answer.
But all that is saying, a rationalist might respond, is going back to the 18th century, is, well, look, God may not exist, but it may be necessary to invent him, because that's what we need to give our lives coherence. It's just the sort of animals we are.
Well, okay, I've heard that argument too, but if one looks at various aspects of science, one finds places where you can no longer go in a knowledge way. You have to accept that there is a mystery beyond simply the factual. We already know that in mathematics. Gödel's theorem of incompleteness tells us that there are some things you cannot prove. In fact, they're incapable of being proved. And some people find that irritating. I find that very satisfying because it's proof of that mystery. I have no doubt that science, physics, chemistry, and all these sciences will keep on making discoveries and explorations and finding new knowledge, but that it is impossible that they will find all there is to find because there is something beyond that that is the mystery.
Behind the mystery, there is something that makes you say it is worth existing in the mystery. Is that something that I guess you could put it in sort of fairly mundane terms as coherence?
Well, in fact, for me, it's a very important part of my coherent view of the world. If there were no such bigger mystery, no such eternity, I couldn't see the point. If the world was simply able to be reduced, if the universe was able to be reduced to facts of chemistry, of physics, of those laws that if this happens, that will happen, and then that will happen. If that's the case, then there is no value to anything deeper. There is no value to the search for happiness. There is no value to love. There is no value to compassion. Because if there is inevitability of the laws of chemistry and physics working their way out, well, they'll work their way out, regardless of what I might gloss over that with these emotions. So not to have a certainty that I do have, that there is something much deeper than that, would leave me feeling very bereft.
What about the afterlife?
Oh, I have no doubt about that. I see what Jesus said as he's on the cross to one of the thieves. This day you'll be with me in paradise, and everything in the Bible tells me that there is an afterlife. I think that those that I have known and loved who have gone before, in the phrase of Zephaniah, being called home, I feel such a certainty of that they have gone to somewhere that is beyond time, that I've never doubted that.
Our guest, Lynn Arnold, former Premier of South Australia, executive with World Vision and Anglicare, and soon to be a deacon in the Anglican Church next week, as a matter of fact. And finally, Lynn Arnold, let's talk about that. Why a decision to go into the church at the very time when, again, taking the measure of society, the church has never looked in deeper, dark odour? The crisis of sexual abuse across the institutional churches, and this could extend across, as the Royal Commission discovers, to other institutions, for the moment, on the churches, and ones in which the churches have not responded particularly well until a fairly impressive array of forces have lined up.
I think there have been some very, very bad responses by the church, things about which the church, as an institution, should be ashamed of, and the dissembling that has gone on is not only wrong, it is tragic in terms of the way in which people who were so badly hurt by these events in the past then encountered this next hurt of the act of dissembling. I mean, how dreadful is that? But my 15 years in the not-for-profit sector brought me very close to the church in action and all denominations around the world. And I met some amazing people, some amazing groups of people in all sorts of contexts who were putting their faith into action. And it took me on a journey that I'd always believed in faith in action, but it made me see how much more was possible with a spirit-led activity. I saw it in World Vision. It is a Christian organization, not a missionary organization, a Christian organization working in right across the context. In Anglicare, I had the chance to be very close to the Diocese of Adelaide and other dioceses and other denominations in Adelaide, and could see this group of people there who were concerned about these issues from a deep cause. So while not running away from the dreadful crimes that have happened, and knowing that they have to be reconciled, there's no doubt about that, I also saw that there were other issues that were being pushed and being pushed in very effective ways. And so that's what made me wonder, was this the role I should move into after having left the not-for-profit sector?
The next question that hangs on that is, why ordination?
Well, in this Lenten period that I went through, I knew that I had to commit myself somehow. And I've been asked since, well, what are you going to be, a deacon or a minister? Well, while I was doing my studies, my genuine answer was, I do not know. I know that I must prepare myself with studies and formation, as it's called in the Anglican Church, to be eligible to be ordained as either a deacon or ultimately as a minister. But I must then also, in an internal discernment, plus an external one of others walking alongside me, then wait to see whether the still small voice of God is calling me to be a deacon or a minister. Now, what's happened is I feel it's now called me to be a deacon, and so I will be ordained as what's called a transitional deacon next Saturday. Why transitional? Because in the Anglican Church, that means that I'm not closing the door on possibly going on to full priesthood, but that I will, so I'll prepare myself with more study and then wait to hear if the ongoing discernment process says, yes, this is the next step to go.
Does that have something to do with the sacramental nature of the roles you're taking on?
That's interesting you say that, because sacraments are a part of the meeting of the eternal with the temporal. You know, we sometimes think of the eternal as something later, but every moment of time has the eternal meeting happening here, because the eternal overlays us all the time. And that meeting point is the sacramental. And so how do we try and engage with that? And so that's the process I've been trying to explore. Now, we do it by our worship patterns, but we're also invited to do it by our living patterns. Hence, I come back to Matthew 25 again.
And after next week, what are you going to be doing? You'll be studying, but what
else? I'll be studying part-time, but what I'll be doing from the next day, well, not the next day, on the Sunday, I'm actually taking part in an MS mud run, raising money for multiple sclerosis and looking forward to having a very muddy time. Doing that with a good friend of mine, Lachlan Pline, who's a mayor, so we're the Power Walk team. I'm former premier and he's a mayor of Unley. But on the Monday, I will start a role at the cathedral, and that role is to be a deacon for faith in the public square. And faith in the public square is about how can we communicate church in society as relevant on social issues, for example. How can we change the narratives of community attitudes? If the community generally has a very utilitarian viewpoint about the worth of people, how can I be part of the church jumping into that space to talk about the preciousness of people, not the utilitarian resource value of people, and other issues? So I'll be working with the cathedral and the diocese on issues such as refugees, homelessness, mental health, reconciliation, and so that's the it's a part-time role because I do a number of other things. I'm national patron of prison fellowship, and I'm also involved in Special Olympics and other things like that.
So there's more to be heard from Lynn Arnold.
Well I hope it's of value. I'm praying that it will be that I will be a vessel that the Holy Spirit will use, and that I won't just be a sounding brass.
Lynn Arnold, it's been great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us on Sunday Night.
Thank you, John. It's been a real pleasure.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday Night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.